With such a large field of candidates, for the first time in decades, Illinois voters could actually help decide who the Democratic nominee for president will be. Plus, Illinois is only one of six states that mandates Holocaust education in the classroom. But how do we know that kids are learning what they need to? We'll hear from some genocide researchers. And we're doing a preview of the 22nd annual Ebert Fest with the festival's co-founder, Chaz Ebert.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Julian Haida. Coming up later this hour, Illinois is one of just a handful of states that mandates Holocaust education in the classroom. But are kids learning what they need to? And Chaz Ebert joins us at the end of the hour for a preview of the 22nd annual Ebert Fest. But first, every 4 years, we've talked primaries in Iowa, New Hampshire, now Nevada's top of mind. By the time Illinois voters usually cast their votes, more than half of the states have already voted. And so that means that more than half of the delegates would have already won. But with such a large field of candidates this year, for the first time in decades, Illinois voters could help decide who gets the Democratic nomination for president when we head to the polls on March 17th. For more on this, we're joined on the line by author and journalist Edward McClelland. He recently wrote about the primaries for Chicago Magazine. And also joining us from Chicago, we have Kitty Kurth. She's a political consultant who's been working on Democratic primary campaigns in Illinois since the 1980s. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. Hi, Kitty.
Hey, Ted.
So, Ted, I'm going to start with you.
Good to talk to you. Okay, start with me.
Sure. So this is the time of year that a lot of us are talking about Democratic primaries. I mean, some people have been talking about it for like a year. But we're hearing about states like Iowa, New Hampshire, not really Illinois. Can you explain why Illinois is usually like a non-factor when it comes to primaries?
Well, usually we vote later in the process, and by then somebody has, piled up enough delegates to either, clinch the nomination or be the front runner. But I think this year, as you said, there are so many candidates, and Illinois is the state that's most typical of the nation in its demographics, and it's traditionally been a state that kind of goes for middle of the road candidates, establishment candidates, and it could be the state that kind of breaks a deadlock between a progressive candidate and a moderate candidate, if that's what it comes down to by March 17th.
Sure. So, Ted, your piece in Chicago Magazine that I mentioned is called "Why Illinois Will Matter This Primary Season." So let's get into some of those reasons. Let's run down the list of some of the reasons you outline. I wanted to start with the sheer size of the candidate field. I mean, there's a lot of Dems running. Like, how's that different from past years, other than the obvious?
Well,
why is that a good
thing
for Illinois?
Yeah, I mean, 4 years ago, it was just Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, she won by 2 percentage points. Illinois has always, in the contested primary era, Illinois has always gone with a winner, except for 1 year, and that was 1988 when Paul Simon, our favorite son, was the candidate and he won. We're a bellwether.
Sure. So, Kitty, Ted mentioned 1988. It seems to be like that was the last time that Illinois was this important. We are a bellwether, as he mentioned. What was going on in 1988?
Well, I'm going to talk about that, and then I reserve the right to talk about California, too, even though we never like to think that California is more important than Illinois. But back in 1988, we had a lot of candidates in the race. They called him the six-pack at the time, but Mike Dukakis was the front runner. Paul Simon was in the race. There was another Illinois favorite son, Jesse Jackson, in the race as well. Dick Gephardt won Iowa that year. So all kinds of things. Gary Hart was the front runner for a long time, and then he was out. It was an exciting year, and things changed and changed. And Illinois mattered then because Simon won and got delegates and got to have a little bit of a say at the convention. This year, Illinois, I would argue, is going to matter a lot more because I don't think that there is going to be any kind of clear message coming out of Super Tuesday. And let's talk about Super Tuesday for a second and California. I've been trying to get national reporters to focus on California since November because California actually started voting the same day as the Iowa caucuses. That was the first day for write-in voting in California. California's in polling place election is on Super Tuesday. 494 delegates come out of California. If we look at Illinois and Nevada and South Carolina and Iowa and New Hampshire combined, we don't have as many delegates as California.
So the assumption might be that, you know, come and go Super Tuesday, all of this might be moot because we're 2 weeks after Super Tuesday and, you know, California will have their say.
I think the opposite, though. I think California will have their say, but also Texas votes on that day and has almost 300 delegates. In addition, you've got all the southern states. I don't think there is going to be one clear answer coming out of Super Tuesday. And just to indulge me in a little bit of reminiscence, Illinois was the next big state after Super Tuesday in 1988. So we had a great Dukakis Super Tuesday election night at the old Vic Theater on Sheffield and Belmont. We had 75 TV screens and 150 national media in Illinois on Super Tuesday because the candidates were looking forward to the next big state, which was Illinois. This time, Illinois votes on the same day as Florida, so I think we will break up some of those candidates' visits with Florida, but I think there'll be a lot of activity in Illinois before our primary.
Sure. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, California, Texas, huge states. Ted, in your article in Chicago Magazine, you talk about, obviously, the number of candidates, which you mentioned, but you know, Illinois does, you know, doesn't have as many delegates as California and Texas, but we do have a lot of delegates.
We have 155, and it's interesting. They're distributed. Some places have more delegates than others. If districts around Chicago, they each have 8 delegates, and in Southern Illinois, they have 3 delegates because it's based on how much of the Democratic vote you turn out in previous elections. So those are the areas that are really going to be getting the focus. But I just, before we talked, I wrote an article, Illinois Primary Power Rankings, for the magazine. And I think I would put Sanders on top right now just because he has this unbreakable coalition of 25 to 30% of the voters. And I think that could be enough in a 7-candidate field.
Yeah. And Ted, looking at, I had forgotten that that Hillary only won by 2 points in the primary against Sanders. And honestly, looking backwards, that should have been a huge flag then that Hillary was going to be in trouble, because for all the times that the Clintons have spent in Illinois since 1992 and before, she should have won Illinois by 15 points.
Right. And, you know, I looked at it. She did better in the more urban counties and counties with a bigger African-American population. She went to Cook County and Peoria and St. Clair and Alexander. And then Sanders tended to do better in the suburbs and then in the rural part of the state.
So that's I want to mention who we're talking to. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. You just heard from Ted McClelland, who's a Chicago-based journalist. He wrote about Illinois' place in the primaries for Chicago Magazine. Also with us is Katie Kurth. She's a political consultant. She's worked on a bunch of Democratic primary campaigns. You know, we were talking a little bit about 2016, and I want to bring in the role of of superdelegates. You talked about how Illinois has a lot of delegates. There's the fact that, you know, Illinois is a pretty diverse state, right? We have a rural area, an urban area, we have blue areas, we have red areas. But I wanted to ask about what role do you think superdelegates will play into Illinois' role here? What are they? I looked at some of the superdelegates from 2016. I mean, it looks like Chicago aldermen, county clerks, political appointees. What role do you think they'll have in this upcoming election?
Ted, I wanted to ask you a question. The 150, I think that's the number of elected delegates. I think our total is more like 184, but I'm not positive. I need to check myself.
I do too. I was just looking over the rules.
And this is one of those questions where if I'm wrong, I apologize to everybody, but I think the 150 is the number that we elect, and then the number with superdelegates is about 184. The superdelegates are, Julian, they're congressmen, some are aldermen, they're DNC members, and they are people that I would expect that all of the campaigns are lobbying those superdelegates right now for their endorsements. And they can go with anybody they want. I would suspect, and here, you know, if I were writing the novel about 2020 rather than a news story about 2020, the novel about 2020 would have Bernie Sanders winning all the primaries and all of the Democratic superdelegates being in a panic and trying to coalesce around some other candidate to stop Bernie. That's in the fiction about 2020.
Yeah, I can't imagine that if he goes with the most delegates and they give it to somebody else, that's going to go over very well with the Sanders voters, especially as much as the Democrats can complain about the Electoral College.
So, I hear both of you talking a little bit about strategy, right? I mean, whether it be, how do you canvass a state like Illinois that is so diverse, unlike New Hampshire and Iowa, that does have the urban-rural kind of difference? I wanted to ask especially Ted, about former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's leveraged some of those strategies in really, really kind of unusual ways. Can you talk a little bit about how that's different than maybe Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg, who have been, you know, successful in Iowa, New Hampshire, and how Bloomberg might play in Illinois?
Well, I mean, Iowa, New Hampshire, because they're smaller states and because it's such a long process, they're more sort of retail politicking states. You know, you go to the steak fry, you go to the county meeting, and you shake people's hands. But Bloomberg is just throwing a ton of money at Illinois. He's spending more money than any other candidate.
Which is a little crazy, Ted, because Bloomberg doesn't have any delegate slates in Illinois.
Right. And how is that going to work? I mean, if he wins 15% of the congressional district, is he still going to get delegates out of that district?
No, because he didn't file any delegate slates, I don't think. Although, honestly, you know, rules are made to be broken and changed.
Right.
And what might happen closer after Super Tuesday, if any candidates do drop out, Bloomberg can lobby them for their endorsements. And then if those candidates get elected as some other candidates' delegates, they could go and then pledge at the convention. They could pledge their support to Bloomberg. But I think our weird early filing, you know, you had to file your delegate slates and recruit your delegate slates back in August and September, so you could be passing petitions in October, November, and December. And Bloomberg wasn't even running then. And I think that's going to be a disadvantage for him. But remember, these are party elections and not municipal elections. So just like the party kind of changed the rules, the national party changed the rules for this latest debate, the Illinois Democratic Party, if they wanted to, could probably change their rules about delegates.
So, I mean,
well, he's
I,
opened
I wanted to. I mean, I can imagine. You know, I mean, obviously, I have the privilege of working in a radio station, and I get to read all this stuff every day. So I imagine, you know, keeping up with these rules being just, you know, mind-numbingly frustrating for average voters. And speaking of voters out there, I mean, you know, Illinois has changed quite a bit. You know, we're talking about Illinois being this diverse place, but, you know, we're facing population loss. We're facing a lot of shifts in kind of our demographics. Will that factor in here? I mean, do you think that, you know, for example, Governor Pritzker's suggestion that Illinois, you know, should go first is perhaps behind the curve?
Oh,
no, I don't think anybody should go first.
You want a national primary day, Ted?
Yeah, well, or maybe a selection of states from all around the country. I mean, if Illinois went first, all the candidates would be in here making deals with county chairmen and ward bosses, and you know, do we want the whole nation decided by Illinois politics?
And I'm gonna talk about it from a really much more practical matter. It's really hard to campaign in 14 states all summer long, or yet again, 50 states all summer long. Iowa voters and New Hampshire voters deserve a lot of respect. They put a lot of time into this. They are good at this, and they go and talk to those candidates and listen to those candidates more than other people would ever have the patience for.
Sure, but they're not reflective of the nation. And in a general election, you do have to campaign in 14 states or 50 states. So
yeah,
I want to thank you for the lively discussion. I mean, we're on a clock here. We gotta get out
on
time.
We'll agree about something.
Well, thank you for giving us some much needed analysis, Ed McClellan. Ted McClellan is a Chicago-based author and journalist. He recently wrote about Illinois' role in the primaries for Chicago Magazine. We also spoke with Kitty Kurth, who's been working on a bunch of Democratic campaigns since the 1980s. Both of you, thanks so much for adding so much to this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank
nice
you.
To talk to you again,
Take
Kitty.
Care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. This spring will mark 75 years since the end of the Holocaust in Europe. As many as two-thirds of Europe's Jews were murdered in the years between 1941 and 1945, 6 million in all, as well as hundreds of thousands of Romani, Gypsies, Africans, Poles, Ukrainians, Russians, members of the LGBT community, and so many others. But in the decades since, there's been at least a dozen other genocides worldwide, depending on how you define genocide and the scale of it. That's why in 1990, the state of Illinois mandated Holocaust education in 5th, 8th, and 10th grade classrooms. Joining us to discuss the state of genocide education and research are Linda Bauer, Executive Director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation.
Hello.
Hi. Brian D. Kahn is a retired educator who now runs the Federation's Holocaust Education Center. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
And Christy Yoder, Executive Director of the Center for Genocide Research and Education. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Now, I should also mention, now that we have you here, that the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation is hosting a number of events in the next couple of months, including a seminar that asks how far is too far when it comes to teaching children about genocide. That's on Thursday, March 19th at 9:30 a.m. at the Illinois Education Association in Champaign. Information on that can be found at cujf.org. Now, Brian, I want to start with you. There's only 6 states that require Holocaust education in schools. Illinois was only the 2nd state after California to pass legislation to that effect in 1990, largely owing to organizations such as yours. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's not more common nationally? Why don't more states teach the Holocaust?
That's a big question. And we've been thinking about that ever since Illinois did become the first state to mandate it. And last that I read, and not to take exception here, but there were 12 states that have a mandate to teach the Holocaust. There are others that have less significant rules. And I think that since Illinois became the first, there was a great amount of interest in the early 1990s. It was, and many people don't know this who aren't in education, you know, it was the multicultural era. It was the era of diversity and of looking at things through the eyes of other people. And the museum was built, Schindler, and in Washington, D.C., Schindler's List came out. There were the Shoah Foundation was recruiting people all over the world to interview survivors and rescuers and other people that were involved. And there was a huge amount of interest in the topic. And a number of organizations got in on that. The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, of course, the Shoah Foundation in Southern California, Yad Vashem in Israel, and the museum in Washington, D.C., also the museum in Skokie. So I think that's...
The Illinois Holocaust Museum.
The Illinois Holocaust Museum, yes.
Now, I mean, so it seems like that interest was certainly there 30 years ago. But just to follow up, like, is there a way of knowing that at least, you know, outside of these institutions that you mentioned in the classroom, that the kind of education that you know, should be taught about this history is being taught, that is being taught on the local level?
How do we know?
Yeah.
Well, we don't. It's a mandate. Mandates often don't have any teeth to them. We don't test on the subject. It's not part of the Common Core, which, you know, we all went through so many years ago, which really dictated what a lot of districts were going to start doing with their curriculum.
We do know that, you know, we have teachers locally that come to workshops. We have, our center has books and a lot of teaching materials that teachers take advantage of. Is every teacher doing it? No, but many teachers are doing it. And I think as an organization, we look at ways to meet the needs of today. You know, 40 or 30 years ago, it was different than it is now. Unfortunately, there are more genocides to think about and teach about. But, you know, how do we teach not only what happened, but what's happening today, and also how does an individual respond? And I think that's what's really important, and we're looking at that as we look ahead.
Sure. Now, I mean, Linda, I'm trying to think of some of the times that I learned about the Holocaust in school. I mean, I was a student here in Illinois after these laws were passed, but I went to a private school, so I didn't, you know, the law doesn't apply, doesn't mandate private schools to teach the Holocaust. Your parents were Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandparents were Osterbeiters. These were prisoners in Nazi forced labor camps. And mm-hmm. I guess that means that, you know, folks like you and me learned from our family's oral history. But that there's a lot of personal trauma there, and you don't really get a kind of systemic analysis necessarily. So I'm wondering why you think that Holocaust education should be taught in a kind of a more formal classroom space.
Because it's human relationship education. It's not just history. We have to teach everyone, but particularly young people, how to respond when they see abuse, bullying. You know, it starts hopefully at an individual level to have compassion to others, to respond and not be afraid to speak up. We all know about that saying of Martin Niemöller, who said, oh, they came for the socialist, I wasn't a socialist, so I didn't speak up. They came for the trade unionists, I was not a trade unionist, so I didn't speak up, and you know, et cetera. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. I think our society these days, I'm talking about American society, tends to be rather self-centered. and even teaching kids how to stop a bully on the playground, or at least to report it. I think that's a step forward.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's very interesting, especially since the preventive aspect of this is it seems so important and so personal. Christy, I wanted to bring you in the conversation as well. Your organization researches genocides and education efforts around them. Why do you think that preventive philosophy is important to incorporate?
Yeah, I agree with Linda. I really feel like it does start at the individual level, and we need to learn to have compassion for one another. From a prevention standpoint, if you get to know people that you wouldn't normally interact with, it's a lot harder to demonize them. This process that's called othering in genocide.
Absolutely.
When you have a name and a face and a story, suddenly you have a personal connection, and that makes genocide thoughts, things that lead up to genocide, a lot less likely.
I see. And I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, people think about, the way, I mean, you mentioned the othering, the kind of the steps that lead to genocide. Linda, you mentioned, I wasn't, that idiom that they didn't come for me, therefore I didn't care. What are some of the ways that people can look out for, a possibly impending an impending genocide or something that might obviously nothing will compare to the Holocaust as it was in the last century, but as we read a newspaper, how do we tell the signs that something is amiss in learning from that history? I mean, Brian, do you have a thought, or Linda?
Well, if I had the answer, I'd win the Nobel Peace Prize. But I did make some notes about thinking about this, because even my parents were both in concentration camps and were survivors. The rest of my family was killed. So I'm very close to this. So even I have trouble trying to figure it out. But just even locally, for instance, some things I've thought about. One is, as was said, is outreach. Be part of the community. Federation has had events that people come to and socialize and mix, and there's not the other feeling. The other thing is to form alliances. I know one of the local rabbis here has been very involved in the Interfaith Alliance with Christians and Muslims and so on. And again, they're part of the community. Another thing perhaps is to be politically active so that you have a larger role in saying what happens. And again, the idea of education and teaching us to value our fellow man, whether they're in the U.S. or in another country.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. We're talking about Holocaust education with Linda Bauer, Executive Director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation. Brian Kahn is a retired educator, chair of the Holocaust Education Center at the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation. And with us on the line is Christy Yoder, Executive Director of the Center for Genocide Research and Education. I wanted to ask, there's a lot of people who invoke history and kind of try to apply it to today. Christy, I'm sure you saw that last summer the National Holocaust Museum condemned some members of Congress for comparing immigration detention facilities near the U.S.-Mexico border to concentration camps. Now, the National Holocaust Museum suggested that analogies to the Holocaust are irresponsible, since nothing can compare to the scale of the Holocaust. But Yale historian Timothy Snyder in Slate wrote that the museum's stance makes, quote, nonsense of the slogan never again, and it provides moral cover for ongoing oppressive policies. How do you think people can sensitively navigate like the tangible history of Holocaust and genocide with other acts of injustice that might happen now or more recently or possibly in the near future?
Yeah, I really feel like keeping the focus on the Genocide Convention, which outlines what constitutes genocide, can really help navigate that, because the Holocaust certainly was the largest genocide to occur, and it made us aware of other genocides. But in order to prevent genocide, we have to understand it. And so in order to do that, we need to study all genocides and see what is there in common between them. that we might be able to use to prevent genocide. And it is a difficult task to navigate that sensitively, but I think that it can be done.
Now, Brian, I want to ask you, since you are an educator, how do you teach that? I mean, we've talked about themes around genocide, around the Holocaust. Obviously, we know the Holocaust didn't begin overnight. There was Kristallnacht, localized anti-Semitic violence that kind of led up to the Holocaust. How do you talk to young people about this, to be sensitive to some of these things that they might be seeing in their day-to-day lives and know that something might be amiss without desensitizing them at the same time?
I think, and I want to build on something that Linda said, I too have hundreds of family members who perished in the Holocaust. I speak to students when I go out to classes about my family, about being Jewish, so they can better understand some of the materials that they're reading. Because often many of the students that we speak to, whether it's in Rantoul or Danville or Westville, are not familiar with Jewish tradition. So when they're reading Night by Elie Wiesel as freshmen in high school, it's very hard to comprehend. So we share about religion. I think that's a very important thing. We share about family. We share about family's experiences, as Linda said. Yes, the history is extremely important. It's there. The path to sound pedagogy teaching the Holocaust is there. It's on the museum websites. It's on the ADL website. It's part of Echoes and Reflections, the ADL's big electronic program. We know how to teach the Holocaust. We just need to follow those patterns. We need to talk about prejudice and discrimination as an introduction. What does it mean to stereotype? What does it mean to use someone as a scapegoat, to try to understand these human relations, and then to look at the historical building? How did this happen in Nazi Germany? Hitler did not invent anti-Semitism, and yet students often walk away thinking that because they don't have the whole history. And I think the same thing needs to happen with teaching other genocides. I don't think we've gotten past the point of trying to grapple with the Holocaust as the one main genocide that we used to teach about. In 06, the mandate changed under Blagojevich. Now we're going to teach comparative genocide. And the mandate calls for superintendents and principals to provide professional development and materials and preparation for teachers. But it only happens in small pockets. It's not happening all over. And I think that's one of our big challenges. We do have materials in our library that address additional genocides. Yes, most of what we do happens to be about the Holocaust in speakers and educator training, but we have purchased materials and we have worked with teachers in teaching about the Cambodian genocide and teaching about the Rwandan genocide. It's just a slow buildup because I think we're still dealing in many ways in our own mindset, we're still dealing with the Holocaust as this model of how to teach genocide. But it's not a secret how to teach it.
Yeah,
it's out there, and we know how to share that with teachers.
Sure. Now, Brian, I want to ask you in your experience, why do you think some people are not so willing to take this up as a subject matter? I mean, there's fear, obviously, but there's a great deal of politics surrounding this. I mean, in Florida, there was last year a case of a principal who was fired for denying the Holocaust. Now we only have a minute, so I know this is a whole big conversation. But why do you think that people are so afraid to teach this?
I think they don't understand. I think that's a lot of the problem. They don't understand the details behind it, the specifics behind it. And yes, they get involved in political struggles within any community. Also, national struggles and standards. How much time do we have to teach this? And are we prepared to teach this?
Well, we should definitely continue this conversation
Thank
another
you.
Time.
Yes.
We
We're out of time, and the teachers are out of time, yes. And that affects us all.
Well, people can learn more at cujf.org. You have a lot of events that people can join the conversation at. And thank you for sharing your perspectives and your stories. I've been speaking with Linda Bauer, Executive Director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, Brian Kahn, who runs the Federation's Holocaust Education Center. And with us on the line was Christy Yoder, Executive Director of the Center for Genocide Research and Education. Thank you all for joining us and discussing the sensitive
topic.
Thank
you so much for having us.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. Now, it's hard to believe with the weather outside, but it's almost springtime here in central Illinois. That means that local film buffs are gearing up for EbertFest 2020, which will be announcing its lineup very soon. Now, the 22nd annual festival honors the memory of Roger Ebert, the famous critic and an alumnus of the University of Illinois. Now, even though we have 2 months to go before the film screenings, the festival's co-founder, host, producer, Roger's dear partner in life and in film, Chaz, is here in the studio to gin up some excitement. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Julian, for welcoming me here to the 21st. I have heard a lot about the 21st, and I was just listening before to your talk about whether we should teach the Holocaust. Of course we should teach the Holocaust, and of course children should learn about it and students should learn about it. I'm going to teach them a different thing. I'm going to teach them about empathy and kindness and compassion and forgiveness and films. So,
well, I mean, that's what's awesome about movies, right? I mean, we in radio, we're limited by our medium. We can only tell people things. We can use descriptive language all we want. Yes. But in films, you really communicate through images.
It's visceral.
And feelings.
It's visceral.
And
yes.
like the image speaks. So, I mean, I understand that every year the festival has a theme and you always bring empathy up. But what's this year's theme for this year's EbertFest?
This year, because it's 2020, a new decade, our theme is transformations. And transformations can mean a lot of things. We have some things where you'll see transformation of characters from the beginning of the film to the end. We didn't really sit down and say, what's the theme? Actually, we don't have themes every year. Sometimes our themes emerge after we put the films together, the program together. And that's kind of what happened this year, except early on, there's a guest that I can't talk about today, but that's where the idea of transformations came about.
So let's run with that some more. I mean, the decade is changing over. What are some of the kind of great transformations in film that come to mind for you, given how much that you can talk about this year's festival? But generally, I mean, we talk about the changes from analog to digital. We talk about the rise of superhero movies versus kind of more drama. So what are some of the kind of transformations that you've seen in as far as people's tastes and
well,
and
some of the transformations, it's hard for maybe millennials to fathom this, but at one time, people thought that the common theme at studios was that you can't have a woman superhero. And now, of course, we know, you know, you look around, not only Wonder Woman, but there are going to be other female superheroes in movies. There was a thought that you couldn't have an African-American superhero. Black Panther showed that to be
huge.
It was a huge film. And not only hugely successful, but it was such a beautiful film cinematically. There are transformations in, you know, one of our guests that I can talk about, our closing night movie will be There's Something About Mary. And I don't know if you've ever seen that film. If you haven't, it's hilarious. I hope it's hilarious to today's audience, too, because it may not be politically correct.
I don't think of, I mean, the movie came out in 1998. I don't think of the late 90s as particularly high art, especially in the way of comedy.
Well, and this one has, it pushes the envelope, or at least back then.
It's a little
then,
vulgar. It's a little vulgar.
It has some maybe coarser moments, yes, but hilarious. And so I'm looking forward to it, and I'm sticking up for it.
We'll so what do you think
Peter
translates?
Farrelly, the director. What I was going to say about the Farrelly brothers movies.
Sure. Dumb and Dumber fame.
They always have a character who is either physically or mental, has some physical or mental challenge. And they do it in a way that it's still comedic, but very sensitive. I love that. And I think it's probably because they may have had either a brother or a son or a family member who had some mental and physical challenges, but they incorporate a character in their movie instead of making it seem like you can't show people who are mentally or physically disabled. And I like that about their movies. They're more inclusive.
And that's such a conversation for our time here in 2020. The inclusivity representation is huge.
Yes,
but we don't think of you know Farrelly movies as
these
comedies, and we think of them as lampooning and punching down. So why will it play?
No, it will. Peter Farrelly and his brother, and the filmmakers, they make sure that they show these in a sensitive way. I'm not going to even tell you what some of the things. Go and read Roger Ebert's review of There's Something About Mary, and you'll see what I mean. But I want to tell you our opening night movie, too. It's Francis Ford Coppola's The Cotton Club. And The Cotton Club was this famous nightclub in Harlem. And it was back then, there were some of the African-Americans were performing on stage, but may not have been allowed to always sit in the audience. So Cotton Club does confront some of the racism of that time in the movies, and it does it in a way that is, it's wide-eyed. You go in, but it also shows one of the things about the director's cut. It shows what happens when some of those African-American performers go home, what their normal life is like. All movies didn't do that. Sometimes they would show African-Americans singing or dancing, but then, then they weren't, they weren't shown as just regular human beings. And I love that the director's cut added the footage to show what happens when he goes home. You see his mother, you see his brothers, and so that's important. And after that performance, after opening night, we're going to have Catherine Bostick on stage with a local trio singing torch-style songs of the kind that you would hear in the Cotton Club.
Yeah, you
it's
always have
be great,
music.
Great.
There's always music associated with Ebert Fest.
I love having some sort of musical performance at Ebert Fest. We used to have it on Sundays. Sundays at Ebert Fest were all about the music numbers, but because we cut out Sundays, because people wanted to get home or get ready, if they lived here, they wanted to get ready for the work week. So Sunday was cutting into their time. So now we're doing it from Wednesday through Saturday. And so we took the musical numbers and put them on opening night. Last year we had the Amazing Grace movie about Aretha Franklin with the performance by a gospel choir from Champaign. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great way of kind of blending mediums and art styles and kind of alluding to the fact that they're all related.
I'm watching you as you, I have to learn how to speak on the radio. I get so, I act like a cartoon character. I get too close to the mic. I speak too loudly. People are like, who is that? And I'm watching you.
That's why Jason's in the control room and he's bringing you down. It went
Jason,
as needed.
Thank you. You are so cool. And I'm going to try to talk like this. Okay. What else do we want to talk about?
We love emotion, just like in film. We love emotion in radio. It keeps people listening.
All right. Roger used to call me Lucy, like from Lucille Ball, because he says I get all animated and I'm a comedian. But it's not that I try. I just get so excited about stuff. I'm just excited about life. I'm excited about coming here. I'm so grateful that Champaign and Urbana still sort of, you know, welcomes the legacy of their son, Roger Ebert. And so it's a really special when I get to come here to do things.
Well, it's really special to have you in the studio. It's really special that you're bringing your energy here, Chaz Ebert. You are the co-host and, or co-founder and host of Ebert Fest here in Champaign-Urbana. We're doing a bit of a preview. The festival is in just about 2 months from now.
April 15th through the 18th.
That's right, at the Virginia Theater, April 15th through the 18th. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the kind of the gist of the festival. I mean, you mentioned Roger Ebert and how he really kind of gave some films the time of day that didn't otherwise usually get the time of day. Now, a theme of Ebert Fest that you program is giving new audiences to films that have been historically snubbed. So what are some of the, perhaps that are in your program this year or not, that you think have been some great snubs in the last year?
Okay, now let me tell you this about the snubbing part. At one time, it was called the Overlooked Film Festival because when we first started it, Roger did not want to have to go to the studios to ask them for new movies. So he said, I want to find little gems that people maybe didn't get the audiences they deserved. So he called it the Overlooked Film Festival. And a few years down the road, some of the directors said, I don't want my films called Overlooked. So we changed it to Roger Ebert's Film Festival. Overlooked was a great name, but we didn't only show Overlooked films. We also showed big films. There are tentpole movies we show. He also talked about overlooked genres, black and white films, silent films, 70 millimeter films. And we still have the Alloy Orchestra presenting a silent film this year called Gallery of Monsters. And they play live while the film is going on, while the silent film is going on. So that's another thing we're having. One of the films that maybe younger audiences may not be as familiar with, an Alfred Hitchcock film. We did an audience survey of people who go to Ebert Fest. The number one film that they said they wanted to see was not the name of a film. It was a director. Show us any Alfred Hitchcock movie. So we're going to show an Alfred Hitchcock movie as well.
Yeah, and he really kind of taught us how to tell stories as opposed to depending on effects and stuff like that. So yeah. It's a really kind of a visual treat when you see a Hitchcock film, any one of them. Now I want to ask you.
So you are familiar with Alfred Hitchcock, aren't you?
Oh, of course.
Oh, great. Not everyone is.
True. I suppose that was just my dad wanted me to see him. I don't know.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also about not only snubs that you've featured and have talked about or unknown or underappreciated or overlooked, as you said, films. But in the last year, I mean, have you seen any movies in the last year that you're like, I think that should have gotten some attention? I mean,
yeah, I can think of a documentary I think should have gotten more attention. Toni Morrison's film, a film about Toni Morrison called Pieces That I Am or something like that. I can't remember the exact title, but I felt Toni Morrison was one of our really great American writers. And she wrote about things primarily in the African-American community. Her writing is brilliant writing. If you've never read a Toni Morrison book, novel, The Bluest Eye, Sula, I mean, just so many things that she wrote.
And we just lost her.
And we just lost her, yes. She just died, you know,
less than
shortly
a year ago,
after.
I think. Yeah.
I hope she had a chance to see the film about her before she passed away. But I actually wanted to show one of her films and have her as a guest for Ebert Fest this year, but she passed away before we could do it. But that's one of the films I hope that people go back to find.
Sure, it's called The Pieces I
Toni
Am.
Toni Morrison's, I think it's called Pieces I
The Pieces I Am.
Pieces I That I Am, yeah. Or something, yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we've had you on the show before to talk a little bit about the Oscars. The Oscars were pretty recent. I was wondering if you saw Parasite, the kind of the big buzz film that's being discussed right now.
I did see Parasite. I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival, and I saw how the audiences went crazy for it at Cannes and continue to go crazy for it all the way up to Oscars, becoming the first international film, as we used to call it, foreign film, to win an Academy Award. I have to tell you, Bong Joon-ho,
The director
was the best guest on the award season circuit. He spoke Korean and he can also speak English, but he had an interpreter. He wrote the most charming, witty dialogue at his acceptance speeches along the way. Even at the African American Film Critics Association gave him an award. He talked about Spike Lee. He talked about Lupita Nyong'o. He just nailed it.
And these are like global thinkers too, which is crazy.
He is a global thinker.
Well, I mean, that's all the time we have. I'd love to.
Oh no, is that
you.
All the time we have?
I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
So
all right.
I've been talking with Chaz Ebert. She programs the Ebert Fest that's coming up in 2 months. I'm Julian Hyde. On tomorrow's show, Brian Moline will be previewing the state's budget address. Follow us on Twitter, 2NST Show. Thanks to everybody who makes the show happen. Jason Croft, Anna Casey, Eunice Alpasan, Libby Foster. I'm Julian Hyde. This has been the 21st.
And Eunice Alpasan was an Ebert Fellow.
Indeed.
Yes.
We're very